Hi, it's Tom here. We've got a great episode of Last Orders coming up for you today, recorded with Toby Young at the Battle of Ideas Festival last weekend, hence the slightly more echoey room than usual. But before we get into all that, I just want to remind you all about a new addition to Spiked, and that's our Spiked shop. You can now get your favourite Spike slogan, be it love Europe, hate the EU, or ban nothing, question everything, on a t-shirt, a hoodie, a tote bag, or a mug. It's the perfect Christmas gift for yourself or your most anti-woke pro-Brexit loved ones. And buying our merchandise is a great way to support Spiked too. So to have a look at the full range, just go to spiked-online.com and hit the big blue shop button in the top right corner. Now, on with the show. Welcome to Last Orders, the Spiked podcast on all things nanny state. I'm Tom Slater, and this is the show where myself and the IEA's Chris Snowden discuss the latest in public health killjoyism, all with the help of an invited guest. Today, we're joined by the journalist Toby Young to discuss how Iron Brew got woke and almost went broke, the strange legacy of Dame Sally Davis, and the creepy use of children in public health campaigns. Hello and welcome to Last Orders, the Spiked podcast on all things nanny state. I'm Tom Slater, deputy editor at Spiked, and today, as ever, I'm joined by the IEA's Chris Snowden. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Tom.
And today we're delighted to be joined by journalist, educationalist and provocateur Toby Young. Toby, thanks for coming on the show.
Pleasure.
So to kick things off, let's do one of our recurring Get Woke, Go Broke segments and talk about Iron Brew, the sugary drink, the Scottish people's favourite non-alcoholic beverage. It's had a bit of a terrible year since it decided to capitulate to the sugar tax and change its recipe. And as we talked about before on the podcast, the backlash was so intense, the sales began to plunge. And now, as Chris wrote about on Spiked the other week, the company has beat a kind of retreat, releasing a limited edition, even more sugary version of the original. So, Chris, can you tell us a little bit more about this? Has AG Barr, who make Iron Brew, given in to all of this angry opinion?
It looks like they're doing so. Yeah, it's not so much opinion, it's just market forces, really, you know. So they famously made this change. The new version, in my opinion, and lots of people's opinion, is rank.
But so too sugary, in which case.
But no, the reformulated low sugar one is, like most of these low sugar drinks, pretty disgusting if you don't like artificial sweeteners. And most of the people in Scotland, which is a market that really counts, agree with me. And AG Barr managed to paper over the cracks for quite a few months because there was a particularly hot summer last year. So soft drink sales will tend to go up anyway. You got people trying it out to see whether they liked it. And I think you had quite a lot of stockpiling. You can still get a can of original Iron Brew on the black market for about £3.99 in some places in Scotland. But then in June, July this year, the reality started to bite. They saw that the sales actually had gone down quite a lot. They do make other drinks, but I mean, Iron Brew is the flagship brand. And they issued a profit warning, and the share price fell 30% in a day. It's since fallen further. All told, since July, it's gone down by about 45%. They said that sales would be down at least 10%. They said the profits would be down 20%. And these are the kind of figures that make you sit up and pay attention if you're an executive or a shareholder of this company. And so last week, Robin Barr, who's I think the great-great-grandson of the eponymous AG Barr, came up with what sounds to me like a bit of a Shaggy Dog story. I'm not saying it's definitely untrue, but it's coincidental timing, if nothing else. He claimed that he'd been looking around the dusty archives in the AGB building and had found this handwritten book from 1901 in which it was written, the original Iron Brew recipe, preceded even the one that we know. And as you mentioned, it actually has even more sugar in than the one that's just been discontinued. And he said it would be a tragedy not to share this piece of authentic Scottish history with the general public. So they are generously putting out what they claim is only a limited edition version of Iron Brew called Iron Brew 1901. And people in Scotland and North England, anywhere else, you know, any people who drink Iron Brew, getting quite excited about this, looking forward to tasting it. And hopefully it will pave the way for them beating a complete U-turn. They've also just released an energy drink, Iron Brew Energy, which has a lot of sugar in it, about 35 grams of sugar in it. So they are clearly moving away from their original promise, which was, oh, we want to be part of the solution, blah, blah, blah. 99% of our drinks have low or no sugar in them. Thanks to the market. So it's a great story.
Toby, what's your take on all this?
Well, I can't say I'm surprised. You use the expression get woke, go broke. Is the expression not go woke, go broke? I mean, I've heard both used.
Scholars differ on this.
A big intellectual argument about
this. This came up in the panel I have just done at the Battle of Ideas, and the example I gave was Gillette. Mm. So Gillette, of course, produced its famous toxic masculinity ad, and as a result, sales of Gillette razors plummeted. Turns out men didn't like being chastised for being masculine, and have switched to other brands. So now I think they've gone back to no longer the best a man can be, and it's back to the best a man can get. I think you see this, where you see this wokeness have a kind of profoundly negative effect on the bottom line is in the American higher education sector. So you may not remember, but one of the first kind of social justice protests to break out on campus in the new era was on the University of Missouri campus in 2015, in which I think an assistant communications professor, when being asked a couple of not particularly tough questions by a bona fide credentialed journalist, refused to answer. And then when he tried to ask a third, she put her hand up and said, "Can we get some muscle here?" As in someone to like strong arm this guy off the campus because I don't want to answer any questions. Anyway, applications to Mizzou, as it's known, have plummeted since this hit the headlines. I think year on year, if you compare enrollment in or applications in 2017 to 2016, they fell by about 35%. They've had to close 7 halls of residence, lay off 400 staff. Similar story at Evergreen, similar story at Middlesbrough. And one particular professor at Harvard Business School predicts that something like 50% of American colleges and universities are going to close in the next 10 to 15 years. Now, there are multifactorial reasons, but I think wokeness is definitely one of them.
And on that, Chris, why did AG Barr go along with this in the first place? Because when the sugar tax came in, some went with it, others didn't. You know, what is it? What was in it for them, I guess, in order to
ruin their own
recipe? Well,
they nearly all went along with it, really. Even Coca-Cola ended up reformulating
other
drinks, apart from Coca-Cola.
Oh, okay. Right? Which they made smaller.
They've taken even more sugar out of Sprite and Lilt and stuff. It's getting quite noticeable.
So we know
these
what
drinks.
The Conservatives are going to say in their manifesto about the sugar tax. They're going to keep it, they're going to ditch
it. I would imagine they'll keep it. I mean, I know Boris said something vaguely encouraging a while ago about how he doesn't like these kind of sin taxes and he wouldn't be doing any more unless there was some kind of audit of them. But I don't see them actually repealing the sugar tax. There's a perception that it's been quite the opposite, the terrible taste, but a great policy by people who haven't tasted it. I mean, in a way, of course, it's not wokiness in the conventional sense. You know, I used the phrase "get woke, go broke" in the article. There is an element of it insofar as part of this woke culture seems to me to be about corporations like Gillette kind of signaling things in a way that goes completely against its basic need to make money. And these people seem to get suckered into it. The guy who runs LucasAid, Ribena, being a prime example. I mean, that did seem to me that the guy himself genuinely believed that his drinks were evil and that he was doing something good by taking the sugar out of them. It wasn't just a commercial decision. It wasn't just about avoiding the sugar tax. This Iron Brew 1901 will not be avoiding the sugar tax, but people don't care. People don't care about paying an extra 8p on a can of fizzy drinks. How much does a can of fizzy drink cost anyway? It varies massively wherever you are. If you want one, you'll buy one. I think it was primarily for the companies that reduced the sugar, it wasn't about avoiding the sugar tax. It was about being seen to be on the right side of history. And it's only when they get clobbered in the marketplace do they beat a retreat. Mm.
Interestingly, on the panel I was on in which we were discussing this, woke corporations. And there was an alliance between me as a conservative and the two Marxists on the panel, sort of united against the kind of apologists for kind of woke culture. And the Marxist view was that it's all just a pretense. This is capitalism reinventing itself, morphing into a kind of disguised bourgeois ideology, typically reinventing itself, propping itself up, sustaining itself in the usual dishonest way. My view is that, yeah, a lot of that is true, but actually corporations will rue the day they've embraced wokeness, because in this kind of social justice virus, which has kind of now entered the bloodstream of the private sector, there is this kind of underlying anti-bourgeois, anti-capitalist agenda, which you know, is there in its roots in kind of the work of people like Foucault and Derrida and post-Marxist, post-structuralist. And that's going to come out. And you see it beginning to come out with the metastasis, with the morphing that's going on within the social justice movement to embrace kind of this radical millenarian kind of extinction rebellion death cult. And that is that the anti-capitalist agenda there is completely undisguised. So I think they're going to, it's bad for the bottom line. And ultimately they've embraced an ideology which seems to fundamentally attack the kind of meta narratives that sustain capitalism.
But because they think it's more popular than it is, presumably. I mean, they're not completely blind to market forces, obviously. I think that the people at Ribena or Iron Brew or these other companies that are reformulating for the supposed benefit of people's health have bought this lie that there is overwhelming public demand for it, in the same way that, you know, Gillette bought the idea that people were extremely concerned about toxic masculinity and so on.
Yeah, that's because their only focus group is Twitter.
Right.
they think that's the representative of the British public.
Yeah. Well, on that count, Chris, do you think we're going to see more kind of AG Barr style bat tracks on some of the sugar tax things? You know, is AG Barr going to be the only company who beats a hasty retreat on this?
I don't know. It depends on the sales. I mean, I am told by people who know about these things that there's a pretty close correlation between sales and the amount of sugar in a drink. And I don't mean the ones that have sugar in them sell a lot and the ones that don't have sugar don't. I mean, there's a kind of linear relationship. So if you just take out a couple of grams of sugar, you will see that in the sales figures. And people aren't thinking about that. People aren't even necessarily consciously noticing that these drinks are changing. They're just one day deciding that actually they've kind of gone off this brand after all these years. So I wouldn't be surprised to see a kind of classic version of LucasAid, for example, come back, because it seems that LucasAid really have lost a lot of sales and they're desperately advertising all over the place and giving away free samples at train stations to try and get over this, but I don't think they ever will. So I think we might eventually see some kind of climb down. I certainly hope so, and hopefully this will not just be a limited edition from AG Barr and they will go through. If they don't, then somebody else should make proper Iron Brew. It's not like it's a patented recipe, as far as I know. You know, the pot man up in Lancashire, when I used to live up there, used to come around with Iron Brew. It tasted just the same as a real thing. So the market should sort this out.
I noticed Cadbury's Dairy Milk has produced something which apparently contains 20% less sugar than the normal Cadbury's Dairy Milk. Have you tried that? Do you know what that's like?
No, I haven't tried it. I don't know what it
sounds like. Terrible.
Yeah, well, you know, if it doesn't, then good on them. But a lot of these things don't even have many fewer calories in them. You know, you can try sticking a bit of protein, a bit of fiber in, but both of those have the same amount of calories as carbohydrates, and sugar is a carbohydrate. So it's really very hard to, as we discussed before on this podcast, really very hard to reformulate a product, keep the flavor, and reduce the calories.
Hi, I hope you're enjoying the episode so far. And if you are, why not take a second to leave us a rating and a review with your podcast provider? It takes just 30 seconds and is a great way to help us reach new people. Now, on with the show. So next up, let's talk about Dame Sally Davies. So Davies is the outgoing chief medical officer, stepped down last month after 9 years as nanny-in-chief, as she was dubbed, decided to go out with a bit of a bang, calling for a ban on snacking on public transport, which got a lot of attention. This kind of particularly mad plan was a bit of a fitting kind of final salvo for her time as chief medical officer, in which she seemed to become increasingly radicalised and risible. Just for some of the greatest hits, she just said, among other things, that we should have sin taxes on foods high in sugar and salt. She's called for plain packaging on so-called junk food. And my favourite, she's told women to think of cancer each time they reach for a sip of wine. Apparently that's what she does. Chris, do you want to tell us a bit about Dame Sally and the sort of legacy that she'll leave behind?
Yeah, I think she actually stood down in either August or September. It was quite a long time ago, but you wouldn't guess, because she never went away. She still hasn't gone away. Just last week. She was at some select committee on health, introduced as former chief medical officer. Well, where's the current chief medical officer? Is she just never going to disappear, this woman? It seems not. And she spent the last few weeks, or the last few weeks after she left the post, banging on about banning snacking on public transport. That's the thing that got the most media attention, but there was various other things in there. And then a week or two later, she came out saying she thought they should ban e-cigarette flavors. She's always been anti-e-cigarettes. So she's basically been on the wrong side of the one important public health issue of her time in office. And all the rest of the stuff is just stupid, badly thought out, top down, blunt, nanny state rubbish, And the report was nonsense. I mean, the cover of the report, I don't know if you saw it, you probably didn't, but it was a very badly designed graph in which you had the supposed childhood obesity figures from 1990 to the present day, and it's a line going up, which incidentally hasn't been going up the last 20 years. And a packet of crisps in 1990, which on the graph says 100 grams, and a packet of crisps today, which says 150 grams. How many grams do you actually think are in a packet of crisps? You ever noticed? There's 25 grams in a packet of crisps, and they have got smaller since 1990. There were 30 or 35 grams. I mean, most people have noticed crisp packets getting smaller. And you would think for a report published by the government, somebody might have picked up, A, the fact that packet of crisps do not weigh anywhere near 150 grams. It didn't weigh 100 grams in 1990. I don't know what she's actually comparing. Possibly she's looked at a multi-buy pack or something like this. But this is the kind of stuff you can only believe if you don't pay any attention to the world around you, if you never eat crisp, if you have the idea that the portion sizes of kind of convenient snack foods have got bigger in the last 25 years is so profoundly ignorant. It makes you wonder about everything else that she says. I bought a marathon from a vending machine, Snickers, I think they're called now, just before I came up on the train here today for a pound. It was tiny. It was barely any bigger than the snack ones you used to get at Christmas time. And I looked it up. There used to be 62 grams in a marathon, as was. There are now 47 grams. All this stuff's been shrinking for all sorts of different reasons. But the idea that it's been getting bigger and therefore child obesity is getting worse is the absolute opposite of the truth. So it's just this one point of many about how this woman really didn't know what she's talking about. She just picks up these ideas from the lunatics at Action on Sugar and regurgitates them.
And Chris, correct me if I'm wrong, but the chief medical officer post created like in the Victorian era or something, it's mainly about cholera epidemics, that kind of thing. At what point does it suddenly become about crisps, and what does that tell us? You know, I mean, Toby, what do you think it is about this tendency nowadays, and it feels like quite recently, for it to be seen as the role of officialdom, you know, to meddle in not just public health, as we all agree is something that they should be concerned about, but, you know, our individual lifestyle choices? Why has that come in, do you think?
Yeah, I think it's always been present in the British character. There's always been this kind of underlying fundamental conflict at the heart of the British character between the kind of schoolmarmish, censorious, finger-wagging scold and the kind of Rabelaisian, badly behaved, overindulgent kind of naughty boy. And one of the things I like about Boris is that there seems to be a golden thread connecting him to all the kind of characters in that kind of in the second camp, Falstaff, Sid James, Jeremy Clarkson. He sort of embodies this kind of Rabelaisian, rebellious kind of streak. Orwell wrote about this, and he was very much on the side of the kind of cavaliers rather than the roundheads in this kind of national conflict. But it's something which kind of flares up from time to time. And I think there's no doubt that the roundheads have been in the ascendancy, certainly since the Blair era, probably predates the Blair era. So my hope is that if Boris does win a thundering majority, it will herald the birth of a new kind of cavalier era in British history. And we'll see the back of syntaxes, at least for a while.
Do you think that's likely, Chris?
Well, he's got a lot of work to do, because it's not just a matter of what the Prime Minister thinks. You've got to, for want of a better phrase, drain the swamp here. You know, there is a vast leviathan, a huge network of so-called public health people paid for by the taxpayer, the chief medical officer's office being just one of them, but also a whole lot of pressure groups and kind of charities and a huge number of academics. I mean, the amount of money going into, you know, junk science academia, all aimed at bringing about particular policy conclusions, is really quite enormous. So, yeah, it's not, unfortunately, as simple as just changing the prime minister, unless the prime minister thinks this is one of his top three priorities and he's really going to go to town on these people, which, you know, fingers crossed, he may do. But I'm not tremendously optimistic, because these people have been working for decades to build up their power base, and it's going to be really hard to knock it down.
And lest we forget, Boris Johnson introduced the sugar tax to City Hall,
and he's just one of the early pilots. Yeah,
so we shall see. Last Orders, like all of Spike's podcasts, is free. There are no subscriptions, bonus episodes for paying customers. We want to reach as many people as possible. But to help us do so, we rely on the generosity of our listeners. So if you enjoy the show and have a bit of money to spare, please do consider making a donation. Anything you can give is greatly appreciated. Now, back to the show. Let's move on to our final topic and talk about Scotland's pro-nanny state preteens, as it turns out. So there's been a call to hide alcohol from view in shops in Scotland following a recommendation from the Scottish Children's Parliament, which I'm sure many listeners will be surprised to hear even existed. So these precocious young people, aged around 9 to 11, came up with this idea all by themselves, only of course they didn't. The Scottish Government got a group called Alcohol Focus Scotland and others, government-funded lobby groups, as it turns out, to talk to the children, and surprise, surprise, their views and recommendations were very much in line with those of their tutors. Chris, we've talked a bit before on the podcast about nanny state sock puppetry, the government funding lobby groups to then lobby themselves in return. But this is a particularly mad example, isn't it, bringing the kids into this?
Yeah, I don't know if it's primarily funny or primarily sinister. It's certainly, it is pretty creepy, I think, this obvious use of really quite young children. Normally people in public health, when they talk about children, they mean like 16 and 17-year-olds. Yeah, these are, yeah, 8, 9, 10, 11-year-olds. Clearly being manipulated. How can they really have any kind of serious view about what alcohol policy should be at that age? It's just the idea is absurd. The Scottish Children's Parliament, I don't know much about. This is the first bit of output I've seen from them, but I dare say the SNP are planning to use these kids in all sorts of different ways to support their position. But it really is reminiscent of some kind of totalitarian dictatorship. I mean, they use, you know, Chairman Mao, and always, you know, photographed with children, and you always brainwash the youngsters the first. It's incredibly cynical. It's incredibly corrupt, really, because what you have essentially is you have a load of activists who are funded almost entirely by the Scottish Government. They work together with the Scottish Government to decide what they want to do. The SNP primarily want to do things that the Westminster isn't doing, because then they can show that there's a purpose to having a Scottish Government at all. And because they can never really legalise anything, and they're not inclined to legalise things anyway, it's a race to the bottom from my perspective. So they're just going to ban things. So you give them a load of levers to pull, they're going to pull them all, just to show that they've got some power. So they want to bring in so far as they can, advertising bans on alcohol. They've already brought in minimum pricing. They want to restrict the number of outlets that can sell alcohol, all this kind of stuff. And so they then set up this children's parliament. They employ again the state-funded temperance groups to brief these kids and help them, you know, come to their decision about what should be done. These kids then sit around. I mean, these are primary school children. They sit around, and Alcohol Focus Scotland say, do you think you see too much alcohol around? Do you think that alcohol should be covered up in shops? And these kids just go, well, yeah, I guess. I don't know. And they come back and go, oh, we've got a rousing majority for banning the display of alcohol in shops. Think of the children. It's just pathetic. And then a few days later, the World Health Organization put out what it described as a report. I can't think what it should have been called, but it wasn't a report. It was literally just picture after picture, painting after painting, done by young children about alcohol. Primarily, these are kids from India and places. And they were just like scary pictures of people with a demon drink. I mean, really based off. There wasn't a word of text in it. It was just kind of policy conclusions even. It was here's some pictures that kids had done saying how awful alcohol is. Bizarre.
What do you make of this, Toby?
Like Chris, I do think that there is something very sinister about using children as proxies to promote a particular agenda. And I think one of the reasons they do it is partly to kind of envelop themselves in an air of innocence and virtue and purity, but also because it's very difficult to argue with a child if some tot is kind of lecturing you on the evils of demon alcohol, you're not going to kind of vigorously engage the 8-year-old girl in debate without risking seeming like a kind of terrible bully. I mean, I noticed this whenever I tried to challenge some of the more outrageous claims being made by Greta Thunberg. When I gently tried to point out in The Spectator that it wasn't absolutely 100% true that no one in Western governments ever talks about climate change. They've just completely ignored it. It's not quite true to say that no initiatives have been taken over the past 25 years to tackle climate change. But even the most mild of kind of critical engagement immediately met with a kind of tsunami of accusations from Tom Watson on down, accusing me of being the most appalling bully. How dare you bully this 16-year-old girl when she's brave enough to take a stand on this vital issue. And it's like, well, hang on a minute. You want votes for 16-year-olds. She's 16. I mean, is the reason you want votes for 16-year-olds so all these 16-year-olds can kind of go around as a kind of Corbynista red army, kind of making the case for socialism, and the moment you try and engage them, you can't argue with them. They're children, you horrible right-wing bully. And it's like, it's ridiculous. They can't have it both ways.
Chris, we talked about it before on the podcast, but can you give us a bit of a sense? I know you've written a report on this, but the scale of the kind of sock puppetry that goes on, you know, and some of the more ridiculous examples of it. Because I think it's an aspect to this whole picture that we don't talk about very much.
I can't give you an idea of the scale of it in terms of money, because there's just so much of it. There's a huge amount from the European Union, but it's impossible to quantify it just because the amount of work required to go through the books, it would just be too much for even a team of people. There is a bit less of it in England than there used to be, but Scotland and Wales have gone even further down that line, actually, over the last 10 years or so. And there's quite a lot from local councils, even though local authorities genuinely have had austerity and seen really significant cuts. Some of them still manage to find money for these organisations to go lobby against.
Last thing that gets cut. We'll cut the social workers, mental health services, you know.
And the groups rubbish are going to complain about the Coca-Cola truck coming to Birmingham.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's very big. I think the solution, perhaps, Toby, is we need to mobilise our own army of children on this. I think perhaps we should fight fire with fire, and we should get ourselves some kids who are even younger to draw pictures about how awful it is that their parents are skimping on treats for the children because they're having to pay so much for their alcohol under the SNP. And have been driven into secondary poverty, and how wonderful fossil fuels are, and how capitalism has saved more lives than anything else. That's the kind of thing.
Well, you can imagine if a kind of, a white male cishet 16-year-old boy was kind of doing the rounds of the TV studios and the radio stations promoting Brexit. You know, as if he'd be given the same license that Greta Thunberg has been given. I mean, you know, everybody would be kind of wailing on him. He people like us would be accused of having
brainwashed him. Yeah, but that's why we don't go for a person like that, do we? We go even further than Greta. Greta's 16. We'll get a 14-year-old. She's got Asperger's. We've got somebody who's got something even more severe than that.
Paranoid schizophrenic.
She's white. We'll get someone from an ethnic minority. We can trump these people if we just, you know, think it through. It's just a matter of recruiting them.
I'm not sure we want to go down that road, Chris.
They'll never be said we're all just groaning and no solutions on this.
That's right. Yeah.
Chris, Toby, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to give us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to help support Spiked to keep us making this podcast and all our other podcasts, as well as our daily articles and essays, then please do consider making a donation. It's really easy to do. Just go to spiked-online.com and hit that big red donate button in the top right corner. Anything you can spare is greatly appreciated. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.